see what it takes.
I don't want that package.
And then you want to open or works a public hearing in the House Book 23.
Okay. Members, we have 3160. We're going to postpone until the chair gets back. She's temporarily out. She will return here shortly. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2233. Call forward Craig Smith and Bill Boyd, please. Welcome. That's right. Megan, will you please read the summary of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. House Bill 2233 allows construction contractors board to impose fees on parties to claims and allows the board to require that claimant prove prior notice to contractor of intent to file a claim. Thank you.
Representative Kitts and members of the committee, my name is Craig Smith. I'm the administrator of the Construction Contractors Board. On my right, on your left, is Bill Boyd. Bill is the manager of the board's dispute resolution program. The bill before you today would be an improvement to the Construction Contractors Board dispute resolution program. The policy decision before you is whether to choose or have a small processing fee on claims and also require reasonable notice to contractors regarding these claims. The net benefit to Oregon would be to provide funds for the processing of these disputes, to reduce frivolous claims, and early resolution of disputes. In the written material in front of you is an outline that talks a little bit about the claims process, about the process that the board has in general. Because of time constraints, with your permission, I'll just go ahead and go through that and get right to the provisions of the bill.
Please.
Representative Kitts, members of the committee, this bill allows the agency to require a fee for processing a claim. Currently, there is no fee required. I want to be clear that this is not a fee to file a complaint that a contractor violated a law. That process results in either suspension of a contractor's license or a fine to the contractor, which goes to the agency. Our claims program results in an order that may order the contractor to pay the homeowner or the other party that filed the claim money damages, and that money doesn't go to the agency, it goes to the claimant. So what we do in our claims program is very similar to what is done in a civil court suit. The issues are very much the same as a breach of contract suit in court. The second part of this bill requires a claimant that's going to file a claim to give 30 days notice of intent to file a claim to the contractor. It's not unusual for a party to file a claim and has never contacted the contractor to let them know about the defect that exists. And in what happens is the contractor is kind of surprised by this claim, and now they've got a claim on their record. This would give them at least 30 days to try to rectify that situation. The fee is set up so that it's limited to the same amount as a court filing fee, which is the upper limit for that is $97. We anticipate that the fee would be about $50. If the claimant prevails on the claimant would be able to recover that money from the contractor. One of the reasons for this filing fee is that contractors currently fund this program through their license fees. About 32% of their license fees goes to the claim resolution program, and we think that based on the theory that there's no free lunch, that the claimant should contribute something to it, especially since if the claims program didn't exist, their only other option would be to go to court where they would have to pay a filing fee. We also think that this would discourage frivolous claims. Every so often we get a claim that is from somebody who has absolutely very, very unreasonable expectations of what they were going to get out of the contract, or in some cases we see a claim that's filed to harass the contractor. We had one recent situation where it was a subcontractor versus prime contractor claim, and the sub admitted at the on-site investigation that he was ticked off at the contractor, and he just filed a claim to bug him. Well, if they're going to do that, I think they ought to pay for it. We have some amendments to this bill, and I understand that they're not in front of you, and I can address those if you like. We've attached an attachment which we've handed out that looks like this, that contains the stuff that's in gray shaded is the new material that we would propose adding to the bill, and there that is described in our documents. I will leave it to you as to whether you want me to go into that or not.
Bill, I would, at this time, we have seven people signed up to testify on this particular bill, along with a very lengthy agenda. So, if possible, and if we could allow the committee, who's probably had time to look at this stuff, and if not, I will indulge them in time to do so and ask any questions that they may have. So, if we could keep the testimony for each individual to about 3 minutes, we would greatly appreciate it.
That'd be fine.
Representative Kitts, the average cost to process a claim is about $330. Some of them go as high as several thousands of dollars. The small processing fee we're talking about here would be recoverable if a claimant wins in the hearing process. There could be a problem if the contractor had filed bankruptcy and there was no bond left. It would be a problem, but that debt would not go forgiven. That debt is still there unless the bankruptcy wipes it out. There may be some concern about material dealers paying a fee. This fee would still be recoverable in the hearings process. And as you know, material dealers, though we do process those claims, those fee or those disputes make up maybe 20 to 30% of our processing. And we believe that it would be a fair thing for material dealers to provide some funding for the program.
Great. Members, any questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bill, can you tell me what the time limit is for filing one of these claims, and does the 30-day notice run concurrently with the time limit that you have to file?
Representative Kitts, Representative Rosenbaum, the time limit to file a claim is either 1 year after a new home is occupied, or if the work is remodeling work on an existing home or structure, it's 1 year after substantial completion of the work. And as the bill is written, it doesn't address that, so it does cut into that time limit. Part of our amendment that is it still at legislative council, includes a provision that tolls that time limit if that notice is given very late in the process. So if it's given within 45 days of the time limit running, it adds 45 days to the time limit based from the date that the notice is given. So after we got the initial bill drafted, we thought about that and came up with a solution.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
What are the filing fees that we're talking about? I'm not familiar with what the filing fees are.
The limitation that this is tied to is the court filing fee, which is, and the maximum is $97. We don't anticipate that we would ask for anything close to that, that we would probably adopt a rule that would set that processing fee at $50. And one of the other changes that we had in our amendment was to change that wording from filing fee to processing fee. Our concept was is that we would take the claim without the fee, look at it, determine whether we had jurisdiction. If we didn't have jurisdiction, we wouldn't charge the fee. We'd just write the people and say we don't have jurisdiction and this is why. And then at that point, if we did have jurisdiction, we would go ahead and say, okay, we're not going to do anything more on this claim until we get our money.
Thanks.
Representative Berard.
As I read the bill, the board has the right to raise that fee, though, at any time they wish. Is that correct?
Representative Kitts, Representative Girard, that's true.
Thank you.
Representative Merkley.
$97.
Up to the maximum.
Of the circuit court.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
There's no other question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, in a situation where a homeowner is aware of the process and files a claim but finds out that the bond is exhausted, would your change to a processing fee address that so that a person isn't filing paying a fee on a situation where you really are not in a position to help them at all?
Representative Merkley, Chair Katz, Representative Merkley. First, we heard about this problem. We hadn't thought about that problem to begin with, but we heard about that today. It's something we'd like to give some thought to. We certainly, during the process of looking at jurisdiction, when that claim is initially filed, we could advise the claimant that there is no bond left or there is a bankruptcy involved and give the consumer an option of whether they want the matter processed or not. It could be a problem in the sense that if the bond is exhausted and the contractor is nowhere to be found, it will be difficult for the consumer to recover that money. So we do see that as a concern that could be addressed perhaps during the interim. We also don't know the volume of that kind of a situation. That's not a common thing to have happen, to have a claim filed against a contractor who's bankrupt in total. Most of the claims that are filed are not against bankrupt contractors, but it is a concern.
If I can just follow up on that, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I think you do have a situation, though, where sometimes people are told, well, yes, you can file a claim, but get in line because there are 10 other claims pending. And then it's a very uncertain situation as to whether there will be any bond money to cover the claim. So that's kind of the situation I'm concerned about. But a related question is, in the law now is the deposit of $100 that can be charged. Why does the deposit of $100 not address the issue of people filing superficial claims? Why doesn't that solve that?
We've never actually used that because for several reasons. One of them is that it costs us money to return the deposit. So if we take that money in and ended up returning it, we've spent some more money on our program and we don't get to keep it. I think that the idea of the deposit was, and it never was very clear as to what the concept of that was, but I think the idea was is that they would file a deposit, and if they got an order, that it would be returned to them. But it didn't seem like a deposit implies it's money that we get and then have to give back, and that didn't really, most of it I don't think would go for our program costs. So it didn't seem like it was a very useful vehicle.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. In the name of time, we're going to move on. Thank you. I'll call forward the next panel together. Scott Berry, Jessica Harris, and Rick Thomas. Panel can be sensitive to the time constraints. The chair and the committee would be greatly appreciative.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jessica Harris, and I will be very brief this morning. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors in support of this bill. AGC and its members are licensed through the Construction Contractors Board, and we view this bill as a very fair way of looking at how to deal with claims. Our contractors are serviced through the CCB. We receive services in exchange for our fees that are paid. And many times when claims are brought, and they may be brought against us or not, and this is a way of, one, preventing frivolous claims, and two, for those claims that cost lots of money, i.e., lots of our fees, it provides a way of a small recovery of that cost and a realization for those that bring those claims of the cost, a small percentage of the cost that is incurred in the processing of that claim. This is fair, it's reasonable, and we strongly support it.
Jessica, Rick.
Chairman Kitts, members of the committee, Rick Thomas with Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. We're here today also in support of this bill. We think it's a good approach to encouraging people to work out situations before entering the system. The current system sometimes encourages people to file claims before really going to their contractor to work things out. Some cases, you know, having like the previous individuals mentioned, unreasonable expectations, working those out, trying to get them addressed before entering the system, and that this also would allow staff to better spend its time on compliance efforts, going after contractors that are working unlicensed in the state, people without a construction contractors board license. For those reasons, we support this bill.
Thank you.
Scott Berry with the Oregon Building Industry Association, also here in support of House Bill 2233. Every year, thousands of claims are filed with the Construction Contractors Board, and all the money collected from contractors, the over 40,000 contractors in the state, is used to cover the cost of that. And this bill simply sets up a small fee to help recover some of that cost. And in fact, our fees actually are going up this year as well with the board. The industry has come in and as a group said, we're supporting those fee increases imposed on ourselves to continue the enforcement cost, to continue covering the cost of claim processing. But we're in support of this fee as well to help, add some funds to the for the cost of the process. There's a number of folks that actually participate in this process who are not contractors and not consumers, and they pay no fee whatsoever into the system. This allows everyone to pay at least a small fee and participate in recovering at least some of the cost.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Carol. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you. I will call forward John Killen and Steve Cafori. Steve, I just want to clarify, you're in support of this bill?
Okay. Good morning, Chair Kitts, members of the committee. I'm John Killen with the Associated Builders and Contractors. Thanks for the opportunity to support this bill. It's a good bill. The bill will relieve pressure created by unnecessary claims. The CCB has proposed a very reasonable fee that would not be an impediment to any consumers that had a reasonable claim. Additionally, this fee will help support the CCB, which is a good program and a strong defender of the consumers. So we ask for your support.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. My name is Stephen Cafori. I'm representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. Our association was instrumental in establishing the CCB in the first place. We think it's an extraordinarily well-run, important institution in the state of Oregon that allows consumers and businesses to avail a non-judicial process, and it's run into some fiscal troubles. This and the fee increase are part of a package to help ensure a continuation of that operation, which we think benefits all Oregonians. Our members are strongly in support of this bill.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Boyd mentioned the possibility of an amendment that would ensure that the year that folks have to file, if you will, won't be shortened by this 30 days. Do you all support that type of modification of this bill that's before us?
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, of course.
Okay. Follow on question. Please. If there is a way that could be found to address the situation of homeowners who are filing, not knowing if there will be any bond there at all to address their situation in the end, would do you think that there's a way to solve that problem within the context of this bill?
Mr. Representative Merkley, I haven't looked at that question, but I'm sure that it sounds like the kind of technicality that can be worked out. And there are a lot of people in this room with a lot of experience in working with the CCB and their processes, and I'm sure that we can resolve that issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, coming from a personal standpoint, at very least the homeowner, if we can't work that out, at very least the homeowner would be able to feel that the next person coming along would get a fair warning from the CCB if they did work with that contractor.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, panel. I will now call up Pat Jones. James? Jones. Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Kitts and members of the committee. I'm Pat Jones. I'm here on behalf of NACM Business Credit Services. I'm employed by Consolidated Supply, a construction material supplier, plumbing supplier. NECM Business Credit Services is opposed to House Bill 2233. We have over 1,000 members and businesses in the state of Oregon. We feel that this bill makes some unnecessary and potentially damaging changes to the Construction Contractors Board law. We don't feel there's a real need for a 30-day notice of intent to file a claim. Our standard business practice and dictates that we send out statements, invoices, and attempt to collect from the contractors. We feel that homeowners as well also make an effort to get their claims resolved with the contractor before taking the step of going to the board. At this point, another 30-day notice, a notice to the contractor when there's already a dispute has arisen, seems to be a redundant situation. Secondly, and probably more importantly, the 30-day notice, when you file a claim with the contractor's board, it starts a 90-day claim window. And any claims that fall within that 90 days are set aside and have priority over claims that would come up in the following 90 days. And so if you add a 30-day notice in for one claim in this window, then that could kick claimants with valid claims into a second status and thereby possibly not be able to recover from the bond. Claimants, we don't think that claimants should be required to pay fees when recovery from the bond is doubtful. The bond is only $15,000, and if there's multiple claimants, sometimes they have to share pro rata, or if it's exhausted, they aren't able to collect anything from the bond. I think there's problems with the bill, and there's no need for the notice. The fees for contractors are very, very small. Off the website for CCP, it only costs $225 for a license for 2 years for a general contractor. If there's additional fees needed, then those fees should be raised. We don't think there should be changes when there isn't answers to these important questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Girard, then Representative Merkley.
I'm not quite sure you can give me this answer, but I'm real curious that how many claims are filed where the bond has been found to be insufficient? In other words, how many people are left hanging there with nothing?
Well, I can tell you, we routinely file claims against contractors as a non-owner claimant. If you're a non-owner claimant, number one, you only have access to $3,000 out of a $15,000 bond. And if there's other non-owners, then all non-owners have to share pro rata of that $3,000. So I can tell you, in many cases, we recover nothing from the bond.
Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regard to the concern about priority, wouldn't everybody be affected by the 30-day notice and then, therefore, I don't see the issue it raises in terms of kicking somebody who's in front to a secondary position?
Well, the way I would state that is if when a contractor starts to go bad, I mean, it becomes evident pretty quickly. And with the small amount of the bond, if you hear that a contractor's gone bad I think it has the potential if you hear 65 days later and you have to send a 30-day notice of claim, when at this point if I hear it in 65 days or a homeowner hears in 65 days that there's claims filed and you need to get your claim in there to preserve that priority, you should have the ability to immediately file that claim to become part of the first priority claim period.
Just a follow-up to clarify. I mean, this really changes this from a rush to file a claim to a rush to send the letter off, if you will, to hold your place in line, and then making sure you 30 days you immediately follow up. But although it shifts the arena, I don't see that it really shifts the nature of the issue you're raising. Am I missing anything here?
Well, no, I don't believe you are, Representative Merkley. I think you could take that view that that it just simply pushes everything out 30 days later. Our position would be that, you know, if a homeowner, you know, if the system would work better if all claims were, you know, shared pro rata and you didn't have these descending priority levels. But I understand your point.
Okay.
Well taken.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Jones, there was testimony earlier that these claims are often filed and the contractor has been unaware that there was even a problem or dissatisfaction with the work. And it seems like the intent of this might be that if that's the case, that there's an opportunity to just fix the problem without having to go through a process at all. Do you think that that has some merit as to a reason for having a notice period?
Representative Rosenbaum, I do believe there is some merit to that case, although I think human nature is such that if a homeowner has a contract with a contractor and there's a problem, I would think that that the homeowner would take every step to contact the contractor and get the problem resolved without having to resort to going to the contractor's board to get their claim resolved. Another valid point is a lot of time that there's construction liens have been filed against homeowners and they need a speedy remedy because they've had to pay twice, quite possibly, and so they need to come to the CCB and get their money back, basically. So another 30-day notice period, I think, adds delay to that process.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That concludes the testimony on House Bill 2233. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2233. Committee, we're going to skip 3145 as the copies are not quite ready. We will be coming back to it. We will then move to House Bill 3051. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3051. I would like to call forward at this time Chief Johnson, DVFNR, and Ken Armstrong of Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've got a few folks here that are going to essentially be part two of our panel. I'm Ken Armstrong, representing the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association, Gallatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and also the Oregon Volunteer Firefighters Association. What you see before you in House Bill 3051 is an exceedingly complex issue. We could easily spend in excess of an hour on this issue. Needless to say, we're not going to. We're going to try and walk a fairly fine line of giving you a feel for this issue, where it is, give you an opportunity to ask some questions. I want to be very clear that we're waiting for some amendments on this bill that we don't have yet. This bill represents probably easily 18 months worth of work between the fire service all the fire service organizations, including fire district directors, special districts association, those that I represent, and others, as well as representatives of the insurance industry. Due to a very complex statutory mechanism, which my colleagues on the panel will give you a little bit more detail on, and I think you're going to have some handout materials, what we have is a situation where funding for the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office is threatened to go away entirely, and that means shutting down the doors for that agency. We're not talking about filling a hole in the budget. We're talking about shutting down the agency, and it is a critical agency. What we are trying to come up with, in concert with all of the groups that I just mentioned, is a way to fix that statutory mechanism in a way that keeps the Fire Marshal's Office whole. So with that said, I want to turn to Chief Johnson from Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue to give you a little bit better feel for the agency, for the problem that we're facing, and then we also have representatives of the insurance the insurance interests, as well as from the Fire Marshal's Office, to talk about this issue. And as I say, I do expect that we're going to have amendments coming back sometime within the next week on this that will flesh out the final details.
Mr. Armstrong, before you go to Chief Johnson, I believe Representative Gourhart has a question.
Thank you, Chair. No question. I just wanted to declare a potential conflict of interest because my son is a fire chief in Klamath Falls. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Kitts, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Johnson, Fire Chief at Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. This bill represents the top priority for the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association and the entire fire service community in Oregon. This bill clamps a statutory artery that, if left untreated, will create a functional disabling of the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office and all the programs that serve the fire service community in Oregon. The history of this bill is that Oregon Revised Statute 731-820 allows for a 1% tax to be placed on fire insurance premiums sold in Oregon. That tax revenue is used to fund the Oregon State Fire Marshal's Office, Oregon State Police Arson, training and certification for fire departments via the Department of Public Safety and Standards. In addition to funding the aforementioned services, the fire insurance premium tax also acts as a second tier of a system that ensures that insurance policyholders aren't left with unpaid claims if their insurance company becomes insolvent or fails. The problem is that the magnitude of insurance claims and losses created by the World Trade Center's attack on September 11th in conjunction with sagging returns of the stock market has caused a failure of an unprecedented number of insurance companies and the reinsurance market. The failure of these companies are causing the fire insurance premium tax revenue to be redirected from funding the State Fire Marshal's Office and those services into a complex financial system which protects the insured's claims in the event of a default. The dollar amount of the diversion exceeds the total annual budget for the Office of the State Fire Marshal for an entire period of 5 years. The actual financial system is complex, and it involves the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. The insurance industry and the Oregon Fire Service has been working together for some months to bring you this solution. 3051 represents a collaborative effort by both insurance and fire service to solve the problem. While the smallest details are still being refined, 3051 represents our best collective work to date, and we'd like to ask for this committee's support in moving it forward. And I avail myself for questions, Chair.
Thank you, Chief. Are there any questions of either Mr. Armstrong or Chief Johnson? And I would also like to claim a potential conflict of interest. Chief Johnson's a very good friend of mine, but I don't see it as a conflict. I see it as an attribute. Thanks for being
here today. Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee.
Nancy Orr, Chief Deputy of the State Fire Marshal. I'm here representing State Fire Marshal Bob Garrison. The state fire programs are funded entirely by the fire insurance premium tax. There's no funds available for those programs. And local fire and police services also do not have the funding to absorb the workloads from elimination of these programs. As Chief Johnson said, our future is devastating. Without the OIGA offset changes proposed in House Bill 3051, the fire program services that are relied upon by fire departments, businesses, schools, parents, and other Oregonians would be decimated. About 85% of the State Fire Marshal staff, fire program staff, who provide these services would lose their jobs. And since there are no alternative funding, these services would be lost. There's a list there in testimony, and we've talked with many of you already about the program services at the Office of State Fire Marshal that range from fire data collection and analysis for local fire departments and the state and at the federal level to mobilization of the firefighters during conflagration and other governor-declared emergencies. We have a strong record of providing quality services to Oregonians and working effectively with our primary partners, the fire service and insurance companies, to reduce fire death rates and fire loss rates in Oregon. And I appreciate your time today and your consideration of House Bill 3051 that would preserve the funding for Oregon state fire programs. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. Chair Kitts, members of the committee, my name is Eric Gablix. I'm the training director of the Department of Public Safety, Standards and Training. I've submitted written testimony this morning, and I just wanted to share a few issues and keep it brief. This legislative fix is necessary for us to continue to serve Oregon's over 11,000 career and volunteer firefighters. We provide training services and certification services statewide to volunteer and career firefighters. The impacts already of the reduction of revenue have required that we close our Metro Northwest office, which left approximately 58 fire departments without direct training services from our agency. Additionally, shortfall revenues we're looking at now will require that we close the Central Point office, which serves 89 fire departments in Southern Oregon. In addition, we would lose one position in certification, which will leave us with just one employee to handle some 5,000 certification requests each year. In closing, last year our training program, as small as it is, reached 4,500 firefighters in the state. That's just under half of the firefighters in the state, so there's a lot of value to the program that we serve, and we just look forward to working with you on a solution to the problem.
Thank you both for being here. One second. Representative Girard.
Quick. What kind of money are we talking about here?
The original revenue forecast, fire insurance premium tax revenue forecast for all the fire programs in Oregon for this biennium was $9.7 million. That's been reduced to 8.6, so all the fire programs have reduced this biennium by another $1.1 million, in addition to a 10% reduction that we took from last biennium coming into this biennium. The revenue forecast for next biennium is even more devastating. It's estimated at $3.3 million. We really won't have final revenue figures until April 15th, or after April 15th, when the corporate, all the taxes are filed.
Follow, Mr. Chair.
Please.
What I'm trying to get my hand on is, how much money will elimination of the offset produce?
Chair Kitts, Representative Girard, elimination of the offset would restore the fire insurance premium tax revenue stream. As I said, going into this biennium, before most of the offsets hit, it was as we're at $9.7 million a biennium. It would also produce revenue for the general fund because the offsets against the corporate excise tax would be eliminated as well with this bill.
Thank you. And thank you for being here today.
Hold on for just a minute. I'm not clear at what point this surcharge gets applied. Is it a surcharge added onto each individual policyholder's bill, or is it the insurer that pays it?
Chair Kitts, Representative Rosenbaum. The House Bill 3051 proposes to replace the corporate the assessments that insurance companies pay to the Oregon Insurance Guarantee Association. Currently, they can offset those assessments first against their corporate excise tax and secondly against the fire insurance premium tax. And the bill proposes to change that offset methodology. Insurance companies then would place a surcharge on insurance, their insureds' policies, so the offsets would be recovered that way.
So a follow-up, Mr. Chair, then it would show up as an itemized charge on your renewal statement when you pay your insurance, is that right?
Chair Kitts, Representative Rosenbaum, that's my understanding. I believe that you have some insurance folks who are going to be here to testify could probably answer that better than I.
Thank you. Seeing no further, I will close the public hearing on 3051. Thank you. It appears that our amendments are still not ready, so I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 3354. I'd like to call forward Gary Bauer, Mike Ganey, Graney. Mike, are you for or against the bill?
For or against.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. We're appearing this morning in support of House Bill 3354. The purpose of House Bill 3354 is to direct the Energy Facility Siting Council to notify an applicant if they are not able to complete their review within the statutory time frame that's set forth in ORS Chapter 469. In addition, it allows an applicant to request the Office of Energy to seek outside assistance if it's necessary to complete the review. And the amendment Mr. Rainey just referred to as he was sitting down, I also want to make it clear that the Department of Justice can do the same. And in all its cases, the applicant for a site certificate covers the cost of any review that the state incurs for conducting this. And I do want to say up front, our preference is to use the Office of Energy staff and the Department of Justice staff. And I'll give you a quick example, though, of what recently happened to us. ORS Chapter 469 establishes some time limits for siting energy facilities and for the siting council to reach a conclusion. However, there's no sanctions if the state does not meet that time frame. But we think the time frame does reflect legislative, at least intent, that the agency concluded and provide an efficient, reliable process for siting energy facilities. Just as the legislature provided a direction to the Oregon Supreme Court to conduct a review within a six-month time frame on energy facilities in order to meet the ongoing energy needs of Oregon. To be brief, we filed an application. It's a fairly lengthy process. I can go through the dates if you want, but let me just summarize by saying that basically what happened is we filed it. The state was not able to conclude its review within the statutory time frame, which would have been issuing a site certificate for a natural gas pipeline that we recently sited, and that site certificate was supposed to be issued back in September of 2002. The council missed that deadline. They just issued the site certificate in March of 2003, and part of the problem was the Department of Justice workload, which kept them from being able to provide a review of some very key elements of some land use laws and other controversial parts of our application. Once we receive the site certificate, though, it doesn't mean that that process is over with. Other parties have an opportunity to request the council reconsider it, and they have an opportunity to ask the Supreme Court to review the application. What happened by missing the deadline in the fall is we don't know if we'll be able to meet the construction window that's available to us this summer. All of our modeling when we started this project way back in the 90s showed that our system needed to be reinforced and we needed to have something in place by next winter. And if we have a severely cold winter, and that's generally in the January-February timeframe for us, we might not be able to provide adequate support for our customers in a number of communities in the western part of our service area in the Portland metropolitan area, which would extend down to Canby. If that happens, there will be some communities who will go without gas for some period of time, hopefully not very long, and there could be some industrial customers who will not receive gas adequate to provide service to them in order for them to stay open and operate. So this doesn't solve our problem, but what it does is it does give us a tool and for anybody going forward to try to work with the agencies and make it clear that that they can go outside and hire resources in order to try to complete the review within the statutory time frame. Thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, I'm Mike Graney. I'm director of the Oregon Office of Energy. The Office of Energy provides the technical staffing to the Energy Facilities Siting Council. That's a citizens panel that actually makes the decisions on site certificate applications. I just mention that I agree with the description that Gary gave of the process for the pipeline. Legislation that was passed last session as part of the response to the energy crisis made a number of changes in energy siting, and one of the provisions was to clarify that we had the ability to go to outside sources if other state agencies that are necessary for part of our coordinated review were not available. We did not anticipate in explicitly addressing that legislation the need for outside legal counsel. And in fact, the bill as drafted really doesn't give us any authority that we don't already have. So it did not come back the way that Northwest Natural intended. So the amendments would do that. The amendments the Department of Energy supports, Department of Justice also supports, is okay with. And let me add, too, that I've provided copies for the committee of some of the results of the legislation passed last session in terms of the site certificates that our siting council has issued. The process, for the most part, has worked very effectively. The siting council has approved over 2,000 megawatts of new power plants since 2001. The pipeline process really did get tied up because of very key, complex legal issues on land use that required extensive Attorney General review at a critical time when we had the special sessions that also took a lot of their time and effort. So with that, Mr. Chairman, can we support the amendments and be glad to answer any questions.
Yeah, it's been brought up that you have not submitted any testimony.
Great.
Thank you. Representative Girard.
Well, as Mike and Gary both know, we have a proposed new project in Klamath, in the Klamath Falls area for a power plant. And when the representative from the power plant proposal was asked in the Revenue Committee to rank on a basis, on a scale from 1 to 10, how was Oregon's process, he gave it an 11, indicating that it was extremely slow. So I'm in support of this bill, and although I know that Mike's Office of Energy have made some giant strides and are continuing to work much to try to get these things through, but again, Mike, we understand you got other state agencies involved that have been slowing you down. So, but hopefully this will help you a little bit.
Thank you, Representative Girard. Seeing no other questions and no other testimony, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3354. Thank you for being here today.
Mr. Chair, are we awaiting the amendments then that they referred to?
Yes.
Okay.
Are we ready for the question? It appears we are ready. We will now go back to House Bill 3154. I will open a public hearing on House Bill 45, and call forward Mr. Jack Monroe.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you do have a -1 amendment we just passed out.
Megan, would you please read the -1 amendment?
While we search for Mr. Monroe. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The -1 amendments replace the bill. The original bill was not drafted as requested by the requesters, the proponents. So the -1 specified that the home protection insurance does not include a home service agreement, defines that home service agreement as a contract or agreement for a specific limited duration to one service repair or replace in an existing home the mechanical or appliance system or the components that break down due to normal wear. And two, it would provide the incidental service repair replacement to cover leaks and failures in roofing systems. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan. Mr. Monroe, thank you for being here today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jack Monroe, speaking today on behalf of American Home Shield Corporation. And as has been indicated, my remarks obviously are directed toward the amendments and not toward the printed bill. AHS is a wholly owned subsidiary of a larger entity that I think might be familiar to you, ServiceMaster Corporation. And that entity, through multiple subsidiaries, basically provides household services, maintenance and repair to people that it has agreements with. One of the subsidiaries being Mary Maids, which does house cleaning kinds of things, another being Terminix, which takes care of critters, and AHS is in the business of, again, through service agreements, providing repairs and replacements and service to appliances and other mechanical systems in existing dwellings. Now, normally I don't think any of you would think of this kind of activity as being insurance activity. And it isn't, but we do have a quirk in the Oregon law that this amendment is directed toward dealing with. Normally, in a property context, wear and tear, for example, is not covered. What's covered in a property policy is indemnification for an economic loss that you might incur as a result of some sort of catastrophic incident. And as I said, these agreements deal with wear and tear, don't deal with indemnification, to deal with replacing or repairing whatever the component is, and really don't deal with catastrophes, although I guess if your toilet gives out, that might be a catastrophe. So really, the kind of services that we're talking about here are really the opposite of insurance-related coverage. This amendment was put together after consultation with the insurance division, and it really is consistent with the position taken by the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, which has long ago concluded that such service agreements are not the appropriate subjects of insurance regulation and are more appropriately dealt with otherwise. Just by way of a little bit more background, the agreements that we're talking about are probably most often utilized in two circumstances. For example, Representative Merkley is selling his existing home, which obviously is a used home, it might be more attractive. It might be more attractive to Representative Kitts as a prospective purchaser if Representative Kitts had the assurance that 2 months from now the washer wasn't going to go out, and that if it did, that that there would be a mechanism in place to cover that occurrence. And so that's one of the ways in which these agreements become attractive. One of the other...
So, Mr. Monroe, for the record, are you saying that I am more attractive than Representative Merkley?
I would not want to go there, Representative Pitts.
I would like you to go there. I apologize.
One of the other ways, I guess, in which these agreements are used, and one of the other markets would be simply anybody moving into a community not wanting to have to go out and find their own plumber or whatever in the case of an incident. And so something like an agreement like this becomes attractive. It's really sort of one of the other indicia, I guess, of how society has changed, and people look at the maintenance agreements for automobiles and computers and yard service and a variety of other things. The quirk in the Oregon law that this is directed toward dealing with is in the early 80s we passed a statute, the definition of which is in front of you, that was designed for a completely different kind of product. It really was an intense warranty product. The problem, obviously, is the operational language that's in that definition. Sounds a lot like repairing a plumbing system or an appliance that might go bad. So the amendment that's before you is surgically put together to take those service agreements out of that definition and therefore out of the insurance code and that whole panoply of regulatory activity. So I think maybe with that explanation, I'd be quite happy to answer any questions you might have.
Questions from the committee, Representative Merkley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if certainly service agreements are under the insurance code, if you will, if you understand what I'm saying, what is there in the insurance code that makes that an inappropriate arrangement?
Madam Chair, Representative Merkley, I think what the insurance code obviously was set up to regulate insurance companies, and it does it in a variety of different ways that range from solvency-related tests, inspections periodically, limitations on, for example, what an entity can or can't do with its assets, rate regulation, form regulation, etc. and it is clearly a regulatory oversight that isn't appropriate for these kind of entities. And in fact, my guess is your next question might well be, if we do this, what remedies are out there for somebody that has one of these contracts? And other than an action on the contract, your remedy, and I think it to be a more appropriate remedy, would be, among others, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, I think you're familiar with it, but basically there are two lines of action under that act. The Attorney General has a broad range of powers to investigate, to enjoin, to get cease and desist orders, to take you to court. And then on a second track, that act provides private rights of action that for damages that include attorney fees and punitives and obviously actual damages. So that's a more appropriate remedy. And in fact, insurance activities are not subject to the Unlawful Trade Practice Act. So.
Other questions? Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to give you a real-world situation and see how this would apply.
Okay.
Somebody has a roof that's leaking around a chimney, and they call someone to come and repair it. Mm. And when somebody gets up on the roof, finds that previous work had been done and somebody had put their foot through the roof. So would this language prevent recovery in a situation like that?
I don't think.
Would you have a claim?
I mean, I guess I'd answer it in sort of two parts. And I obviously have to look at one of these agreements that, for example, provided the kind of protection you're talking about, or ostensibly provided the kind of protection you're talking about. First you go to the contract, I guess. And if the contract either provided for the coverage, it would presumably provide for it. It might well exclude some kind of previous damage because, a policy or an agreement that you've entered into to pay $200 or $300 for potential appliance-related problems probably isn't going to take on the fact that somebody put their foot through the roof and dealt with it. So you first look at the contract, and I guess if you thought that the contract covered it, then you'd end up and you could not get any action, and you'd have these other options. The same thing would be the case if it were in the insurance code. I mean, you'd be looking at the contract here. You'd be pursuing a slightly different secondary act of trying to resolve the issue. Which would incorporate going to the insurance division and filing a complaint, and they would get involved in taking a look at it.
Representative Shoffler.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Monroe. I, as I told you, I don't have any problem with this, but when you install certain appliances, you may vent them through a roof, and you may put your foot through the roof doing that. Now, so it could possibly be directly related to an appliance. Is that in reference to that, Representative Rosenbaum's question? Now, would that, you see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, I guess I don't have any more specific response than I offered to Representative Rosenbaum, in the sense that we'd have to look at the contract to see what kind of roof malady was covered and what might be excluded. When you come in, for example, when you buy one of these contracts, there are obviously some things that are excluded. I mean, they are going to fix probably, not probably, I've looked at this aspect of it. If the refrigerator goes down, a motor related problem or whatever, they're going to fix that. If it happens to be a little bit of rust on the shelves, that's not going to be covered. I mean, I know that to be an excluded kind of incident. So one would, again, have to go back and take a specific look at the language and match it with the facts of the situation.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jack. Appreciate it. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3145, and I'm going to open a public hearing, a work session on House Bill 3145.
Madam Chair, I would move that we accept the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 3145 and move it to the floor. Well, I guess you have that first.
Right.
Sorry.
Representative Kitts moves the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 3145. Is there objection? So ordered. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that we accept House Bill 3145 and move it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3145 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Merkley.
Madam Chair, if we have a representative of the State Insurance Office in the room, it would be helpful to get their perspective on this bill since it's changing their jurisdiction.
Representative Merkley, they had an opportunity to sign up and they did not do so. Further discussion?
I have a couple other questions about this. That one is whether there is a parallel here to electronics contracts, such as the type you buy when you're in the store, if that serves as a precedent for the functionality of this type of arrangement. Would it be okay with the chair if our representative addressed that issue?
Representative Merkley, we have a number of bills that we have to get to, and in fairness to people waiting, I think we have allowed questions on this bill. So now we are in work session. Further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Representative
Berard?
Aye.
Representative
Merkley?
No.
Representative
Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Votes aye. Motion carries. And we're the sponsor.
We just do the amendments.
No, we voted on the bill. Representative Gallegos, will you carry this bill?
Sure.
Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3160. This is the tax credit, and it has a subsequent referral to revenue. Representative Kitts.
Madam Chair, I would move that the Committee on Business and Labor move this to revenue with no recommendation.
No recommendation. Okay, Representative Kitts has moved House Bill 3160 to the Committee on Revenue with no recommendation. Is there discussion? Okay, clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. Motion carries.
Thank you.
Off to revenue.
The advance.
And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2859 and have the staff explain the situation on this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. 2859, the Health and Human Services Committee is working on some issues related to this and requested that we just send this bill over to them so that they can work with it on their other issues. And it imposes a moratorium on it. Enactment of health insurance mandates.
Okay, committee, this has been requested by Representative Cruz, who it's more of a health care issue, so we would like to refer it to them. Representative Kitts?
So would you refer it to Representative
Health and Human Services.
Okay. Madam Chair, I would move that we move House Bill 2859 to Representative Cruz's committee, Health and Human Services.
Representative Kitts has moved House Bill 2859 to the House Committee on Health and Human Services.
Without recommendation.
Without recommendation. Is there discussion?
Yes, ma'am. May I? As this is written, and I assure you, if this gets to the floor, I will definitely be voting no on it. I just wanted to say that for the record.
Okay, I appreciate that, Representative Shoffler, and we are not taking action on it, and we are not giving recommendations.
Okay, thank you.
Other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Votes aye. Motion carries. House Bill 2383, if there are people waiting, that does not have its amendments, and so we will not be hearing that bill today, correct?
Correct.
We had hoped they would skid in at the last minute, but We're sorry about that. Okay, I'm going to open a, close the work session. I guess we did that by voting, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3130. And this was the bill we heard considering privatizing the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. It has a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue. I've spoken to Representative Shetterly. He says we sent it his way. He will try to determine what to do with it. So do we have a motion?
Madam Chair, I would move that House Bill 3130 move to Representative Shetterly's Committee on Revenue.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3130 to the House Committee on Revenue without recommendation. Is there a discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Edwards?
Aye.
Representative
Berkley?
Aye.
Representative
Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative
Kitts?
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Chair Close?
Both aye. Motion carries. And I'd just like to say I thought we had an excellent hearing on that bill. However, it does have significant revenue issues, so I think it is the right thing for us to do. Okay, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2019, and Jan Amling has been waiting patiently. Could you please come forward on this bill? And staff will read the summary, and committee, we have for the amendments that Representative Merkley requested.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2019 authorizes a debt consolidating agency to charge credit counseling fee when a debt consolidating agency demonstrates the need for the fee. The credit counseling is required by rule of law, or the director gives written approval to charge the fee. We have two amendments. We have a dash one and a dash two. The dash one came from the proponents of the bill, which prohibits the debt consolidating agency from receiving a fee from the client until the first installment under the contract with the client is paid to any creditor of the client. And then the dash two amendments, which came out of our discussions as a committee on the 12th of March, requires a debt consolidating agency to disclose in all its advertising their charges for services and to prominently display charges for services at their office. Requires a debt consolidating agency to disclose in a form to the client at the time of entering into agreement with the client the amount the agency charges for the service to the client. Requires the client's signature on the form acknowledging they understand the disclosed information. And it specifies that such an agency commits an improper practice if these things do not take place. The dash twos just came in yesterday, and the committee wants to take a look at those to see if it really truly is what they want.
Are the dash ones and twos in our packet?
The dash ones you got in the former hearing.
Yeah, and they also are in the packet. The dash twos were sort of were paper clips on the back. David does not have them.
Jan, do you want to comment for us, please?
I have a little confusion in terms of reading this. I've read it several times, and each time a little bit more sinks in. And it would seem that Mr. Merkley's concern was that fees for the counseling session would be made public. And I'm not sure if this is limiting itself to counseling fees or all fees, and I just would like a clarification. I can go either way, but I would like to know what the interpretation is as we go forward looking at some of the competition and what they do and don't do.
Okay. Can you refer us to the actual section you're addressing?
The first page of the three page, it talks about fees, disclosure and advertising, agency charges for services. It just, as you read this, it would suggest that the person is going to be responsible for a series of fees, and they would be. In other words, if we could charge for counseling, it's conceivable they would pay a counseling fee, a setup fee, and a monthly fee that they would be paying. And to me, those would be the three fees that would be listed. But it seems that when Merkley was suggesting that if we're going to charge for counseling, that he wanted that to be in advertising, this does more than that. That's by reading this. But then you go to the last page, and I'm confused under Section 5 whether it's only talking about advertising. This Section 5.2 says Section 3 of this applies to advertising that occurs in the contracts or agreements entered into. So I'm just confused as to how broad this is, and I don't care. I just want to be clear on what it is because I can live with whatever the determination is. I just want to know that everybody's playing by the same rules.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Jan, these are not the amendments that we requested. These are more extensive than what the committee requested, which is a little upsetting to us. So I would like to direct you to work with Legislative Council and ask them to limit it to what we said in our discussion.
Which was advertising, just for clarification. Was that Mr. Murphy's intent?
I believe so.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'd just like to make clear for the record that the point I had made didn't have to do with advertising. That was raised by someone else, nor was I consulted about these amendments. So I want to be careful to disassociate myself from this particular approach. The point that I had made in this committee was that when someone comes in for counseling, to be have put before them a prepared for them the possibility of a contract to consolidate their debts, that they should not be put in a position of a heads I win, tails you lose. That is, either you sign up for this contract in which we consolidate your debt, or we charge you a fee. Unless the person had been explained in advance that that was the case, and that they had acknowledged that they had agreed in advance to such a fee if they decided not to sign it up for it. I felt that was important to ensure that people coming in the door didn't feel like they'd been taken advantage of one more time, and that it was a fair and open process for all participants. So that was the point I made, and I haven't had a chance to review this amendment, so I don't know if it addresses that point or not.
Representative Murphy, I think there is a problem here. We have submitted in writing the amendments we wanted, and we've not gotten them. So we're going to need to go back and work with Legislative Council and have them produce what we asked. I apologize, but I will take that on, and we will have it back next week.
I'll be glad to work with Legislative Council because there are some phraseology. First of all, a client does not sign an agreement with us for services unless we're going to be dispersing the money every month. And so the language here is saying that if it were only to be addressing the fact that they were going to have a counseling fee, it's talking about the fact that they need to sign some kind of a paper that is separate from the agreement, but before the agreement would be signed. And that's a moot point if it's only anything to do with advertising.
I agree. And if you could write that up for us, we will take that to Legislative Council and make that point.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I raise one other question?
We really don't have time. Could you work with Jan on it privately? Because she will be working with Legislative Council.
Yeah, but it's not on this amendment. It's on the amendment.
I don't want to take the committee time right now.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to close the work session on this bill 2019. We have two more bills, committee, and we are running out of time. So,
just one more?
Uh-huh.
Which one?
Okay, that's the one. All right, excuse me. We have one more bill. We are running out of time, so I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3042. And we have about five people here. And the staff will read the summary, and I'm going to invite up Bob Shiprack of the Building Trades and Jared Broadfoot.
Members of the committee, House Bill 3042 requires contractors and subcontractors on public works projects to pay state prevailing wage rates on federal prevailing wage rates, whichever are higher, and project is subject to state and federal prevailing wage rate laws. And it does have a subsequent referral to wage.
Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary of the Oregon Building Trades Council. I want to frame briefly for you what the bill does and doesn't do, because I get so close to this stuff that I assume everyone understands it. And what the bill does, first of all, I should say this is current law in the state of Washington. I copied it directly from the Washington Administrative Rules, where it's worked fine for many years. What the bill does is it applies to what we call federally assisted projects. For our intents and purposes, if you want to look at what this really looks at, is federal interstate highways. 90 to 95% of what this bill would address would be federal interstate highways. I-5, 84, 205, 405, and I don't think I missed another one. These are typically a 90-10 or 80-20 federal-state split on the funding. It may, in all fairness,
I thought about it might apply to some light rail work and perhaps some sewer and water projects, although the feds have pulled back quite a bit on funding those projects. These projects are today governed by the Federal Davis-Bacon Act, which is a federal prevailing wage law. The bill does not apply to state or municipal projects such as schools, roads, utilities, or state projects such as the state prisons, office buildings, higher ed, things like that. Those are governed by Oregon's state prevailing wage law. And it does also not apply to pure federally funded projects, such as a federal courthouse that we're going to build in Eugene, and prisons such as Sheridan, dams on the Columbia River, things like that, which are purely federal projects. Again, those are governed by the Federal Davis-Bacon Act, and those do not apply to this bill either. We have, as I've described, two prevailing wage laws in Oregon: the Federal Davis-Bacon Act of 1931 and the Oregon Prevailing Wage Law of 1959. I always like to point out both were signed by Republicans. We haven't forgot that. They're good people. Oregon law is similar to the state law in 35 other states. The intent of both laws are to establish what are known as area standard wages and benefits. A very key term. Both conduct wage and fringe benefit surveys of contractors to determine these area standards by craft and region of the state. The survey methodology is not the same, but for our purposes they're pretty similar. Basically, survey contractors get your wage and fringe data by counties, and then they're published. The key issue is whether or not the union wage and fringe benefit is paid to 50% or more of the workers. That's the 50% rule. Both the feds and the state use that. If that occurs, then the collective bargain rate is said to prevail, and that is important to understand, as I will describe later. The wage and benefit data is collected, collated, and then published. You can get the Federal Davis-Bacon information right off the internet. State of Oregon Employment Department and BOLI publish our rates every 6 months. It's important to know for this bill that today the Federal Davis-Bacon rates meet or exceed the state prevailed rates in a predominance, a vast predominance of categories. So what's the problem? The state surveys contractors every year and updates the rates every 6 months. The federal rates are based on I spoke to San Francisco this morning, actually was a 1991 federal survey. These are upgraded frequently to reflect changes in collective bargaining agreements. In 1995, a limited federal survey was conducted but not published due to lack of data. In 1997 or 98, a statewide federal survey was conducted, but we were notified in December of last year that the Department of Labor was throwing the survey out because of a, quote, total computer failure. At the time, we were told the DOL would survey Oregon this year. In February, I was told by San Francisco that any survey was to be put off indefinitely. One section of the 97-98 survey that was published were some residential rates for federally assisted housing. We call them the HUD rates. These rates upgraded survey results from a 1979 residential survey that had only been upgraded to reflect increases in state and federal minimum wage. That data was that old, still is in many cases. This bill is here to deal prospectively with a likely upcoming problem. If a federal survey is conducted, and it will someday, and certain crafts or counties do not prevail, their wages and fringes are frozen until the next survey is completed and published. Given our track record, possibly a decade later. DOL estimated a 7-year cycle in 97-98. You're not going to even make the 7-year cycle. So if you don't have a collectively bargained rate that is published until the next survey, those rates are frozen. They are not upgraded. I'll try and wrap up real quickly, Madam Chair. In closing, in 1994, we had ballot measure 12 on the ballot to repeal Oregon's prevailing wage law. It was defeated 63-37% statewide and failed in every single county in Oregon. In 1995 legislature, the building trade unions agreed to annual surveys for establishing state prevailing wage rates and no longer simply adopted the federal rates, which were predominantly union rates. We stepped up and said that objective surveys to establish area standard wages and benefits was responsible and would eliminate criticism of the state prevailing wage law, which it has. Today we are asking the legislature to continue that deal that was struck in the 1995 session and pass House Bill 3042 so that when the situation I have described occurs, we will not suffer from an unfair, dishonest, and faulty survey system. I talked to ODOT about the bill this week. They estimate, because as I said, predominantly on this type of construction work, the collectively bargained rate is in effect today, so they estimate a zero fiscal impact from the bill. Also would mention, this isn't going to be a big issue in the Tri-County area where over 50% of all construction is done heavily unionized, but it would have a big impact on rural Oregon where you could have, if we don't do anything, a federal survey is conducted, it turns out poor. A good example for you, Madam Chair, since 1991, for instance, the cement mason's rate in Coos Curry, Douglas, and Josephine County is $10 an hour, no fringes. Since 1991, it's still there. It's totally, nobody works for that. The feds will not, probably going to hear from the opponents that the real answer to this is just have the federal government adopt the federal surveys. They are not going to do that. They did at one time in the state of Hawaii several years ago, have pulled that program. Federal Department of Labor has repeatedly told me that they have no intention of allowing states to use their surveys for federal purposes. Federal Highway Administration allows legislation like this. Obviously, they allow it in Washington. And, of course, if there was a difference, that money, since it is federally assisted, would be paid for out of the Federal Highway Federal Highway Program. I'm going to stop there. See if you have any questions. I hope I've adequately explained the difference between the two cycles. Surveys and the potential problem would exist if there is a survey done and it doesn't reflect area standard wages.
Well, thank you, Bob. It's a complex subject. I imagine we do have some questions, and you've done very well clarifying it. Questions? You've done really well clarifying
it. It could only confuse you, or you've already
saw in advance. That's why.
Okay.
The main thing, Madam Chair, is that our surveys are done annually and they're published. The federal surveys, as I've described, some of these rates are over 10 years old now.
And they have a lot more money than we do, don't they? They do surveys.
Not at the Department of Labor.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And we will call next Dan O'Brien with Electrical Contractors and Jessica Harris, AGC.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris, and I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors in opposition to this bill. Here with me today is Dan O'Brien with Curtin Electrical Construction, a member of our Legislative Committee and Board of Directors, past president of our organization that has been involved with Oregon's prevailing wage law for a very long time, and part of the reason why our law is the way it is and such a great law. I'm going to turn it over to Dan to talk about his perspective on this bill and why we have significant problems with it, and then
I'll go ahead and wrap up. So,
good morning, Madam Chairman, Representative. I'd like to talk about, I've been involved in the prevailing wage law since 1993 in the state of Oregon. Helped the process through 1993 and 95 in passing House Bill 2992, which revised the prevailing wage law in this state, which required that we go out and do surveys around the state. And I agree with former Representative Shiprack that the law is very credible and has done a very good job inside the state of Oregon. There's a couple other clarifications I'd like to give you. Is that fourth out of the 40-some thousand contractors in the state of Oregon, there's less than 4,000 that do the public works projects we're talking about, and that includes all the highway, bridges, buildings. Everything is done in public works and the commercial and industrial construction arena. So we're talking about 4,000 contractors here. The biggest problem that we find with this bill is the fact that now we're going to have to compare two surveys. Here's one. This is broken down by every region. There's over 100 pages in here, and there's also a federal survey out there. And now you're going to make the contractor bid time walk up, grab his books, and try to go through and determine what he needs to pay employees to, at this time. And that's a very, very time-consuming task, in particular at the heat of bid time and trying to get your information together. The second point is, and I agree with former Representative Shiprack, is that the federal survey is a joke in the state of Oregon. They don't do surveys, but they do step up and take collective bargaining rates in most of the areas in the state of Oregon and use that as a basis of their wage rates. And that's primarily the reason I'm opposed against it, because we have several areas of state, including Benton County, that have quite a few crafts that unprevail. Down in Klamath Falls, there's areas that don't prevail. So if we all of a sudden step up to the wage rates as published by the federal government, we're going to step up to a significantly higher wage rate, and those contractors in that area are not going to be competitive. One other thing about the prevailing wage rates in the state of Oregon and the federal prevailing wage rate, it's not a maximum pay rate. It's a minimum pay rate. They set the levels and the basis by which you're supposed to pay, and as a target, you're to meet that as a minimum basis. It's not a if somebody wants to pay more, as an example, if a rate is $14 an hour for a painter in Benton County, the contractor can pay $20 if indeed that's what it takes to actually get. He gets to make a business decision on what he wants to pay and what he actually wants to bid for this thing. The confusion is that we're comparing two wage rates at time of bid, and it's going to create a real problem for the contractors that are actually working on this. I do want to comment that the Oregon prevailing wage law, this issue was brought up at the Bureau of Labor and Industries Prevailing Wage Advisory Committee, and that committee chose not to address it in this manner. We discussed it, and that's as far as this matter actually went. I am personally opposed. I am a representative of the Associated General Contractors, Oregon Columbia Chapter. We're opposed, and the Independent Electrical Contractors, which I also am a member, were opposed. So there's three of us. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I just want to reiterate that the concern that we have is that there are opportunities for contractors to set the rate. The market does determine the rate. The reality is, for highway contractors, Scott Williams with Hamilton Construction, I had a conversation yesterday. Highway construction, by and large, is federally assisted. But with the OTIA money, Oregon Transportation Investment Act of 2001 and 2002, that is state money only. And those projects that are starting to hit the street are subject only to Oregon's prevailing wage law. And what they're finding with their employees is they can't do the swing. They're paying federal Davis-Bacon wages, which are, by and large, higher than Oregon wages. They can't do that swing with their employees, so they pay the higher of the rates. They walk into a small community and the rates are lower. As a matter of treating employee fairness, and contractors, highway contractors, are located in a few areas and do extensive travel around the state just because of the nature of their business, it's the same story. The market and their ability to keep what is a relatively few number of employees in this state that do highly specialized highway work dictates the wages that are paid. And that we are not in a situation where those kind of wages are toggling back and forth, because, quite frankly, you can't keep employees for $10 an hour in Coos County. It just doesn't happen. So our concern is one administrative. You look at the federal rates, they're broken down into much that you've got 10 or 12 categories on say, trucking, whereas in Oregon, you have two or three. So you have to look at, okay, well, which is higher if you're using this category, that category, and it is an administrative nightmare, very costly to the contractor, time-consuming, and that's only going to cost the taxpayers more money and more time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have John Killen and John Oshel. John, I can't read your last name. Association of Oregon Counties. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Close. Again, the rest of the committee members. John Killen for Associated Builders and Contractors. We agree that with the proponents that we need some clarification in this area. We agree that the federal rate is a bit of a mess and difficult to deal with because it is out of date. However, we oppose the bill as written. The federal prevailing wage surveys are out of date and the state rules are confusing enough on their own. Our main element of contention here is that there are two rates. And most of the folks I talked to said that that's the biggest problem, that the BOLI rules are already so complicated, they spend so much time trying to figure out the various categories, the regions, the overtime, etc. And now they would have to compare all of those elements mixed in together to all of the elements over on the federal side as well mixed in. It'd be an administrative nightmare for most of them. And granted, this is only a few select contractors, but they feel very strongly about this issue. If we were to clarify one way or another, just Oregon, just Fed, we'd be much more comfortable. But at this time, we have to oppose this bill.
John Oshel, County Road Program Manager with the Association of Oregon Counties. First, although we note we're in opposition to this bill as written, we do need to be very clear about one thing. The Association of Oregon Counties is resoundingly neutral on the issue of whether there should be a prevailing wage and what those rates should be. We have county commissioners very clearly on both sides of that issue. So as an association, we're very neutral on that point. Our problem with this bill is just related to the efficiency of it. In other words, even though we have people on both sides of the issue, everyone agrees that if we have it, it needs to run efficiently. Have two sets of rules where you've basically got to figure out the wage and the benefit, and then some of them the benefit depends on whether you've got another program, and to try and figure the two sets of rules out, difficult for the contractor, difficult for the agencies that got to verify that the contractor is doing it correctly. This just has a real potential for lots of administrative problems and costs, and that is our point of opposition on this. Just the additional confusion caused by on a employee-by-employee job task by job task, because as you know, if the employee hops off one piece of equipment and climbs off another, his rate may well change. Too complex, too confusing, our perception for the potential benefit that it may ensue by doing it. So based on that administrative problem, we are opposed.
Okay. Questions? Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just was wondering if you're currently working with the Bureau of Labor and Industry to try to address the problems that you're concerned about.
Representative Close, Representative Rosenbaum, we have a variety of members that are in a variety of different discussions with BOLI. There are lawsuits, there are discussions, there are rule committees. There's a variety of efforts going on, yes.
And speaking for the association, we have individuals who are working, frankly, on both sides of the issue, on this issue. As an association, we tend to stay out of that fray.
Representative Shockley.
Yes, ma'am. Chair, thank you. It seems if some industrious computer programmer would make some software that we could just plug hours and job description in, push a button, and there's pay stub printing out again. Thank you for that, Madam Chair.
Is that a business you may start?
Not me, but I'm good with a shovel. But as far as it goes.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Jared Bradford.
Thank
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot of PacWest Communications, here today representing the National Electrical Contractors Association, the Plumbing and Mechanical Contractors Association, and the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association. Combined, those three contractors associations represent over 1,500 contractors within this state with an average of 10 employees. So we represent quite a few people. Just to start with, I think Mr. Shipwreck did an excellent job explaining this bill and clarifying exactly what it does and does not do. I feel that between his testimony and mine, we've been experienced to a good job of confusing the issue. Contractors have to research the prevailing wage rates anyway. That is part of what they do. This bill says you deal with the state or the federal rate, and it is up to them to figure that out. I do not believe this bill will create an administrative nightmare, as has been stated. I feel this does give us some comfort, and like Mr. Shipwreck said, the federal survey has not been done, but we do a state one every year. To keep contractors competitive, in our mind, contractors stay competitive, yes, with rates, with prices, but also with skills and with the job that they do. And if at $10 for Coos and Curry County for the prevailing rate, people will not work for $10. I used to work for $10 when I was in high school for Les Schwab, but now I don't, and I don't expect these people working for contractors to do so either. And finally, this bill only applies to federally assisted projects. So what we are looking at here is a very simple bill that tries to address a problem, and I think we need to keep our focus on exactly that we need to keep focus. Prevailing wage does have support in this state, and the people that do get paid the higher rates and get paid, these are the people that are putting money back into the economy. So rather than have a debate on whether prevailing wage is good or bad, we need to focus on what the bill does, and that just says whether we use the federal rate or the state rate. So I'll be happy to answer any questions, but we would appreciate a work session to move this bill at a future date. So.
Questions? Representative Roy.
Representative Schaffler and I were just commenting that both of us wished we were earning $10 an hour.
Maybe you need to have a new lobbying group for destitute legislators.
You start a union. That was good. I got to give you that.
We didn't hear that.
To the bill.
To the bill.
Excuse me.
Other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much. Well, that went faster than I expected it to, committee. We do not have a work session scheduled for this bill, but I think this was very interesting and to hear both sides of the discussion. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3042. And I apologize. I thought we had still to hear House Bill 3354, but apparently that needs amendments. So, okay, so 82 amendments, right?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Well, without further delay, we are adjourned.